Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Extra Serving, a podcast by The Last Bite Network, a production of Nation's Restaurant News and Restaurant Hospitality. I'm your host, Holly Petrie, and I'm joined by my colleague.
My name is Sam Okus, editor-in-chief of Nation's Restaurant News.
It was a short intro today, I know, because we're still catching up from the new year.
Caught me off guard there. Yeah. And it's just the two of us today. I hope we have enough to talk about when it's just the two of us. We're lacking all of our coworkers. It's a slow week this week.
I mean, I think we talked for like 15 minutes before we started recording. So not a shortage of things to say, just appropriate things to say.
You're going to collect bloopers for Extra Serving at the end of 2022?
We did have a theme song. So if anybody wants to hear it,
that's for our Patreon subscribers. Our Patreon donators get to hear all the bloopers for the episode. Actually, it's not a bad idea. I'm going to put that away in the idea box.
And our theme song, which is just so lovely. Sam and I sing it together. We harmonize. It's great.
But if you're listening to the free version of this podcast right now, I'm sorry. You don't get to hear it.
No. You'll have to subscribe and be one of our patrons. Patreons?
No idea. We're wasting everybody's time right now.
All right. So it's the new year. Sam, we were talking a little bit before we went live about how you have no resolutions. So you're a load of fun.
Yep, thanks.
No problem. You make my job easy as always. So thank you for that.
Sure.
So what are some things, you know, you're looking forward to this year? For the restaurant industry, for yourself, you know, what are some things that are positive that you think are going to come out of this year?
Sure. Well, happy new year, everybody. It's good to be back in 2022. I would say, well, look, I was telling Holly before we got on that I don't do New Year's resolutions because I have done them in the past and I'm just really lousy at keeping them going through the year. And so I reached a point where I just decided why bother making these if I'm just going to give up on them. But then also it just feels like, I don't know, I highly encourage everybody to do them if it works for you and if it's a good way to, you know, set goals. But I get in my head about like, why should I wait till the end of the year to set a goal? If I have a goal, I should just make the goal and go for it. So anyway, I don't have formal New Year's resolutions. What I want for myself this year is, hey, this is my first full year in this role with you guys here at Nation's Restaurant News. And I am excited to have a full year to for us and our team to be able to create awesome products for the restaurant industry and to be able to continue talking via podcasts and video and at nrn.com and through the magazine and sharing all the lovely news and insights that we have with our audience. And so I think it's going to be a great year. We have a lot of cool things coming up.
Always from the NRN. Salesman. Always the salesman. You just got to have your spiel ready. Yep.
Yeah, this is how it works. Gotta spin it. We've got, I will quickly, briefly preview that here in a couple of weeks. We have something very exciting coming up, which is the Power List. I will save spoilers and just say that it is awesome. I have been working all week this week on finalizing edits for the Power List, and it is great. You know, and then later this year, we have all sorts of fun things. Top 500 Create is coming back for a second year. We have monthly Create Digital, just like last year. Anyway, a long-winded way of saying that I don't have New Year's resolutions, but I do resolve to have one great year as NRN editor-in-chief, my first full year. You're shaking your head as if that's just not a, like, you don't want that to be a resolution for me. You don't think
so
I should.
Boring. Oh my God. Such a snooze fest.
Well, what's your resolution? Tell us what your resolution is.
I told you, you got to think of easy stuff to do. I told you one of my resolutions was to make my bed every day. And then you made fun of me for not being an adult. Like,
yeah, because that shouldn't be a resolution. It should be a thing. It's like brushing your teeth. You don't want to make a resolution to brush your teeth every day. You should just be brushing your teeth every day.
No, I used to be the kind of person who hated getting into a made bed. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to make my bed every day because I like the way it looks and it makes me feel better. And so I'm doing that.
You used to be a college student, in other words.
Through my late 20s, yes.
Yeah, okay, sure. Everybody's got to grow up at some point.
It took me until my late 20s to decide to become an adult, but I'm doing it. And so I just write it on my list every day, and then I check it off. And I have lists now.
Lists are good, yeah. Okay, I guess I will say, and this kind of came up in our previous conversation too, is that if there was one thing I want to be better at, it is being more organized and being more on top of keeping my things, my lists are good and just having an understanding of what I need to do and when, because I'm a pretty, I don't know if spacey is the right word, but a lot of things go in one ear and out the other. And so I need to write things down more. How's that? Yeah, for
you're not a multitasker. Let's put it that way.
I don't multitask well. No, I cannot process something that's happening over here while something's going on over here, which is great when you have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, by the way.
See, you already brought up your children.
There we go. New Year's resolution.
Where's bingo? Drink. Somebody drink. I hope you're listening to this at like 8 a.m, whoever is listening, and they just had to take a shot because
speaking of, how's New York going right now for you? How's Omicron going in New York City? Seems like things are pretty dire there in New York City these days.
It's great. I was not tested, but I'm pretty sure I just had Omicron. So
I think everybody in New York City had it. Everybody I'm talking to in New York right now is like sniffles and just not great.
It was brutal. It was very brutal. I mean, I was too sick to get tested, but it was not great. I mean, you saw me one day. We were in a meeting, and I think I like had a hallucination in the middle of one of our meetings.
I had to tell you to go take a nap. You were not good.
Like, it wasn't fun. So it's not great, but New York City is wonderful. It snowed today. So I got to see the snow. It's the first snow of the season. I love snow. Snow. I love snow. Okay. Thank God Leanne's not here today because she hates snow. But I love snow. So I was very happy. And I have a fern outside.
It's very appropriate not to, but Leanne flew off to Phoenix and it's almost like she sensed the snow coming.
She always
does. Amazes. She pulled that off.
It's uncanny. She does it every year.
Interesting.
But so my resolutions for the month of January, as per usual, as my millennial self, have to be on trend. I'm doing a vegan January and dry January.
God bless. I don't know. I couldn't. That's all. It's just two things. I don't.
Well, I was sick for 6 days. So
yeah, that's a natural first week went by real quick. Those things. Yeah.
I bought I will say vegan is easy. I used to be a vegan for about 5 years. So that was super easy for me. But the no drinking is harder again in my late 20s. Alcohol is great. So I bought a lot of, we love alcohol here.
Oh dear.
Bought a lot of, non-alcoholic solutions. So I did a lot of research on non-alcoholic drinks to have, so I could still have that same relaxing feeling of pouring a drink at the end of the day, having a way to close out my day, but not having the alcohol or not having a hangover or not having any of those sort of feelings that come with it. So I did a lot of research into like adaptogens, which our colleague Brett Thorne would be like, those are fake. But
yep, that was a good Brett impression.
But I did a lot of research into that and to kind of like see what some of them are meant to help you like calm down at the end of the night. They have CBD in them. Some are meant to like boost you up. And so I just found it really interesting kind of researching the whole industry. So I learned a lot.
There you go. You should do mocktails. Exactly. Have you looked into mocktails?
No, I bought stuff to do mocktails. I bought like some tonics and I bought something called Kin Euphorics. They have like this mixer that they have that you can mix. So I'm going to start making some mocktails end my night. So I'm very excited. It's going to be fun.
That was popular, not to get into the whole kid conversation again, but that was very popular in the Okus household when during two pregnancies that Katie, my wife, was really into mocktails. And in fact, she was pregnant for her 30th birthday. And so I threw her a little party at a Mexican restaurant and consulted with the Mexican restaurant ahead of time. And they did a little menu of mocktails for her. Where do we go from here? What do we do now? We should talk about restaurants.
Where do we go from here now?
Anyway, restaurants.
Well, so on New Year's Day, I went to Lady Bird, which is an Overthrow Hospitality restaurant here in New York City. We interviewed them on In the Kitchen with Brett Thorne. Robbie DeRossi was on in December, an episode. They are a vegan restaurant in New York City, but he started with Death & Co. So it started as a bar, with the original concept. So they had a mocktail on the menu and I was very interested and I actually ordered the mocktail. I was like, oh really? On the first day, I'm testing myself already with, because the person I was with was ordering alcohol, and I was like, I will take the mocktail, please. So it was a real trip. I can't imagine how Katie did it for 9 months twice.
She did not enjoy it so much. Because you don't even get the, you know, when you do dry January, part of it is about health and being able to take care of yourself and your body. And I think she was not very happy that the not drinking could not be then paired with losing weight because you're also pregnant. So I will add not to do a self plug here, but my birthday's in January. And that is one of the reasons I never do dry January too, is because I always know I would like to have a beverage to celebrate my birthday. And so here we are.
Just one.
Yeah, sure. Just one.
Just one bottle.
One. Yeah, sure. I mean, and my birthday's on a weekend this year. Well, it's on a Sunday, but still it's on a weekend. Yeah.
Are you going to tell us the date?
I guess I can. January 23rd.
All right. Well, we'll have to have a special shout out for you. 2 weeks.
Oh, thanks.
So close. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be 50, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. I mean, the grays are coming in. So yeah, I'm here come my 50s.
Listeners, he's actually very young.
Come on. The gray hairs, remember?
He's a millennial. He won't admit it, but he's a millennial.
Old millennial.
Still a millennial.
All right, spirit.
So let's talk about work.
Yeah. Restaurants.
Restaurants. All right. So the biggest news, I mean, we could talk as much as we want about what we hope for 2022, but everything is so up in the air. The biggest news right now that we have in restaurants is the Great Resignation. It's everywhere. It's on the cover of newspapers. It's on the cover of everywhere you look, the Great Resignation. And restaurants have been hit really, really hard. So, I mean, what are we looking at here?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the important things to know about the Great Resignation. I'm not going to be able to have any hard data here, but something I was just reading was about, you know, a reminder that it's not necessarily the Great Resignation as it is the Great Transition. People are not quitting their jobs and exiting the workforce. They are quitting their job to go get another job. And so, but that's particularly bad for restaurants because, you know, the restaurant industry is, you know, when you have low wage jobs, you're going to have people who quit jobs to go to higher wage jobs. And so, you know, this industry is really having to come to terms with the fact that if you do not increase your wages, if you do not pay a livable wage in a period of transition such as this right now, you're going to be at risk of losing employees who are going to seek out higher wage jobs. So I think that's, you know, that's a big thing for restaurants that they have to confront right now. And obviously they have been for several months, but, you know, thinking about 2022, I mean, I think this, I just have a feeling this is going to be a theme all year where we're going to be talking about restaurant jobs and labor and how do you find quality employees. And there's not going to be a silver bullet, but I can tell you that it starts with just paying a livable wage because, again, people are not leaving the workforce. They're not choosing to say, I don't want to work. Most people can't have that option. You have to work to make a living. And so if what it is that people are in a period of life where they're reflecting and they're thinking to themselves, you know what, I want to look for something else. I want to pursue bigger ambitions. In particular, I want to pursue a higher paycheck. That means going from something like the restaurant industry to something else. And, starts with higher wages. We're going to be talking a lot this year about how technology plays a role in labor and how restaurants leverage technology to make, you know, the jobs that humans do more efficient, but also take away some of the jobs that humans have to do because technology can do them. That's going to be a big theme this year because all of that technology is here. It's really come on the scene the last year, but 2022 will probably when it really goes mainstream.
I mean, do we think that some of the issue with the restaurant industry losing jobs is also that there is this stigma around it that it's not a place for a career, that it's constantly had this stigma that, you know, you can't have a career in a restaurant industry. It's not a job that has a career path. It's a stopgap. It's a job to just go between rather than having a trajectory to go somewhere.
For sure. I mean, that's something the restaurant industry has combated for a long time, but you know, I see this more and more today, which is restaurants talking about this as, you know, when you talk about training programs and you talk about, you know, new ways to recruit, a lot of what they talk about is how do you position this as not just, you know, come make $12 an hour and, you know, whatever. It is, you want to be a part of our team. You want to be a part of our culture, our system. You want to be proud to work here, and you want to see this as just the stepping stone to something else in your career in the restaurant industry. And, you know, obviously that's a lot of talk for a lot of companies. But I do legitimately believe that a lot of restaurants are getting good at, or a lot of restaurants do offer a great system through which people can build up a great career, and that leads to wealth. I mean, I'm just always amazed when you think about how many restaurant executives, how many restaurant owners, chefs, how many of these people start as busboys and they start washing dishes, they start, you know, as a cashier. And this industry is the most incredible launch pad to your future job. But you're right, too often the stigma is to my future job in another industry. Fact of the matter is there is so much opportunity in the restaurant industry to do something more that gives you a great lifestyle, living and paycheck. But restaurants have to communicate that to their new hires. And they also have to show it, right? I mean, something I think about with the labor issue is incentives could go a long way toward, you know, keeping people around in terms of like, you know, if 6 months you can, you know, get a bonus or a pay raise, and then you have eligibility into a program that, you know, gets you this training, and maybe you do stock options. We're seeing a lot of these creative things coming around from restaurants that are just trying to do anything they can to keep their quality employees around. So yeah, it's no silver bullet again, but I think restaurants will have to focus really hard on that question of how do we convince our workers they want to stay around, we're going to pay them well, and they can see this as something that has forward trajectory for their career.
I think one way to do that, I mean, you know, I'm not a professional, but I have worked hourly jobs and I've worked salary jobs, and I think one just like a marketing trick is to tell people about their jobs in terms of a yearly salary versus an hourly wage is, I think, a really great way to kind of give somebody more of a sense of the fact that that you belong with a company, that it gives you more of a sense of like, here, you, even though you're getting paid hourly rates. I mean, technically, I think everybody gets paid hourly rates. They break down salaries. That's just like life. You have to know what you're worth, or companies know what you're worth at all times. So, but like if you make $15 an hour, which is the minimum wage in New York, it's like $34,000 an hour. So you could $34,000 a year, not an hour, just whew.
Some jobs in New York, some jobs in New York do get that. Yeah.
Where is that job and will they hire me?
Go down to Wall Street.
But like, if you say, you know, come with us, you can make $34,000 a year, you can make $36,000 a year. I feel like that's more enticing. And that's more of a way to say, like, we want you to become a part of our team versus like, we're paying you by the hour. I feel like by the hour almost feels like they care less. And if you have if you're like, oh, you know, we're imagining you here for a year, we're imagining you as like part of us, we're like, it feels it's a marketing ploy, but it feels like a way to bring people in a little bit and make them feel warmer.
Well, it could only be done as hypotheticals because you, in the restaurant industry, especially, you know, you can never guarantee a certain amount of hours. So you can never say, well, you'll make $30,000 at the end of this year. But if you framed it as like, you can come here and make the equivalent of this, then yeah, I mean, that could speak to employees if you did that. I really do think, though, it's a matter of, and again, not to spoil anything with our power list, but we got some real interesting people who are going to be on the power list that can speak to this, which is to say, it has to be showing how a company is developing programs for its people. And how do you walk with your employees through the phases of life? How do you teach them about financial management? How do you show them how much they're worth? I think the point you're getting to, Holly, which is true, is that you can't just make it about a number per hour. It has to be about showing them that this job opportunity is so much more than that X dollars per hour. And so again, the industry is getting creative with it. And in a couple of weeks when the power list comes out, you'll know some ways in which some people are getting really creative with it. But yeah, I think the great resignation is happening because people are thinking more about what they want to accomplish with their lives. And they are thinking more about their self-worth. And so if you can plug into that and show them, here's how our organization fits in with you and your goals for your life, and what we see the worth and value in you, then I think it's going to, I think you'll get people who want to work for you.
Yeah. I mean, there are some really great examples on the power list, some ways that people have been taking the work week and transforming it, some ways that people have been using language classes to really bring together employees. So, I mean, it's a really cool list, and there's really great strategies that you can learn from that people have been doing. It's going to be a great list to really build off of and for people to see and grow from and to get really great ideas.
For sure. And I hope that 2022 can be a benchmark for restaurant companies to say, you know what, we've gone through this turbulent time, not just with the pandemic, but with labor generally. And hopefully 2022 can be an opportunity to say, you know what, by the time we got 2 years into this, and by the time all the labor stuff was coming around, we said, we're going to build the foundation for the future now, because this can't be a roller coaster anymore. I mean, look, we're in the midst of Omicron. Who knows what's next? Upsilon or whatever, you know, like I think it's, we're going to have to get used to.
You were totally in a fraternity, weren't you?
No, I'm not, but I did make the joke earlier that we'll name the next one Phi Beta Kappa or something like that. But unfortunately there were a lot of fraternities in my university, so I heard these letters a lot. But you know, the point is that like, this is going to continue to be a roller coaster. We're going to have another surge. I think we can't say to ourselves, crossing our fingers, that there's no another surge. I think we know by now this will be a thing that happens with, you know, varying levels of severity. The point is like, so you can no longer ride every roller coaster, you know, surge and decline. And this is a bad metaphor, but just the point is that like, build a foundation that survives surges of COVID and every other thing to just be something that's invested in your future and long lasting for your people.
I mean, God, the labor crisis turned into the great resignation so quick. It's just, we really just zoomed right past there. So you got to always be prepared for whatever is going to happen next, because we thought it was a crisis and now it's the great. So, you know,
and we've said this on the show before, but all these things tend to be cyclical, right? I mean, you know, labor will get to a point where there's going to be high unemployment and restaurants are awash in great talent. And then it'll come back around to a point where, you know, that it comes back to where the labor issues are happening again. So, you know, the point is that, you know, you shouldn't ride every wave for what it is. You should just have something stable and consistent, a foundation that no matter the state of employment, people want to work for you.
What a great note to end on.
Thanks.
And now for our interview, Lisa Jennings interviewed Kristen Barnett of Hungry House, which is a really cool like ghost kitchen-y company out of Brooklyn where I am. Well, I'm in New York City, but Brooklyn's very close by. it's an important differentiator here, Sam.
I guess those of us non-New Yorkers need to understand.
But it's very cool. She has a very interesting website. It's built by, she used to work at Zuul. So it's built by and for millennials, people who are on the internet, people who are really focused on the way that things look and the experience. It's about chefs and a really touch forward experience with chefs, but still being this ghost kitchen. So definitely stay tuned and listen. She's really interesting, and it's a great interview.
Okay, so I have Kristen Barnett, who has just launched the new Hungry House, a ghost kitchen, or an anti-ghost kitchen, as she's about to explain, in New York City, in Brooklyn, actually. Mm-hmm. So let me first start you out, Kristen, by explaining what Hungry House is. And we're going to talk about how it's different from others out there. But first, give us the landscape. What is Hungry House?
Sure. So Hungry House partners with today's most interesting up-and-coming voices in the food industry to cook their menus in our kitchens, basically be able to tell their story, feature these items, and actually sell them through the Hungry House web platform. So our whole model is really allowing these new, you know, culinary leaders to basically monetize something great that they've made or the following that they've built by leveraging Hungry House's operations and technology to create new concepts and bring to life new menus that customers want.
So you have a facility in Brooklyn that is, tell us about the facility itself first.
Yeah, so we're actually cooking out of the Navy Yard in Building 77. So it's a food hall style environment. You can actually come up to Hungry House, look in this gorgeous window into our kitchen, order at the counter through our kiosk. We have about 1,000 square feet of space where we cook all of the different menus simultaneously from our season one partners that we feature right now on our menu.
Okay, and so this is basically a licensing situation. So it's not like Zuul. We're going to talk about your background with Zuul, which was more of a rentable kitchen space kind of situation. Right. This is where you guys are operating and employing and taking the recipes of your partner chefs and restaurateurs and then executing. Is that right?
That's correct. Right. That model has totally exploded in the last 18 months with the pandemic. This idea that you can now license really any restaurant and cook it from any kitchen, right? And so as I watched this space evolve, you know, I thought about, well, what is like the best, most exciting content and intellectual property out there? Well, for me, and for I think a lot of people in New York and other cities with really strong food communities, you started to see Instagram pop-ups happening, people selling things online and innovating in new ways. And so what we do is we help bring those new concepts or food voices that are finding success online into the real world with Hungry House cooking the food, controlling the supply chain, hiring the talent, training them, and putting those recipes into our systems to make sure that we can successfully execute the vision for these menus.
So for the consumer, really, it's almost like a virtual food hall, a little mini food hall within a food hall, I guess it would be, right?
Yeah, we have a variety of options, you know, available simultaneously. So we see consumers coming on Tuesday for lunch to get a salad. They come back Tuesday night to pick up a burger to go home. And then on Wednesday, they're coming back and ordering a Caribbean grain bowl. And so the variety of different moments of our customers' lives, whether they're feeling more indulgent or they want to feel more healthy. So I wouldn't necessarily go and call it like a food hall, because I think that does call to mind like walking into a space and seeing different stalls. Really fundamentally, we are one operator, we're Hungry House, and we feature these amazing collaborations simultaneously in our kitchen.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the brands so that we can get to where they are. So you have, I think, four operators basically that you're partnered with, right? Tell us a little bit about who you've got.
Yeah, so our season one partnerships are amazing. We're so lucky to partner with them. We are working with Martha Hoover, the Patashu Empire in Indiana. She has a number of exciting restaurants there, but one in particular that I've been watching as she created it during the pandemic, and it's reached a lot of success, called Apocalypse Burger. Amazing, nostalgic concept that smash burgers, homemade aioli, these like really amazing gooey cheese sauces, and the whole thing is infused with this really fun, bright personality that is fundamentally very digitally driven. Our second partner that we've worked with on a menu is Chef Ralston Williams of the Food Sermon, a very highly regarded voice for Caribbean food. He comes from St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and he created the Food Sermon. So for him, you know, he was looking to really extend his brand and work with someone who could really help the brand and his story leverage technology to reach more people. And then we have Woldy Cucina, this incredible Filipino chef who'd been running really successful pop-ups during the pandemic. I myself liked to attend them. His food has incredible flavors, and he was doing catering and pop-ups, really excited to scale his brand. And basically have something that was a lot more scalable and easy for him to be able to invest in brand building while we took care of operations. And then the final partner is the GoodSmart. And this is actually a convenience store. And so they do a digital curation of snacks and beverages that are primarily sourced from the Brooklyn companies and really feature the best of New York. And so they're an incredible convenience store. They're expanding. They actually just opened in Rockefeller Center, and we are giving them access to all of the Brooklyn market as well now.
And so you're saying season one,
yes,
for those of us who are streaming fans, but is the idea here that the brands that you're working with might change for another season, or that the menus might change? What will that implies change? What will be season
two? Yes, exactly. So seasons imply change. And so most restaurants, when you think about it, they change their menus, right? Whether it's with the season or just to bring on new, exciting menu items. For us, I wanted to be able to create a lot of hype and excitement around who we're working with. And so the concept of the season for me was a way to organize that change and build anticipation of what's coming next. The way we see it rolling out is a combination of changes in the menus of our partners. So this could be Woldy introducing a new Filipino dish and us creating a lot of excitement around that. However, we also do plan that our partnerships will rotate in and out. So we are, understanding that in this ecosystem, these are brands that have a lot of different goals and focuses, right? Some are looking to come into a new market. Others might be looking to trial and experiment with some new sauces or signature items that they've been working on. We're a really great platform for different use cases, whether it be new customer acquisition or just monetizing your following, right, that you so carefully built up over the years. So we anticipate there will be different timetables involved with that as well. And that's okay. It creates more space for us to have a greater impact and feature new exciting voices.
So I mentioned that now before this, you were the COO at Zuul, which was really, I think, one of the first ghost kitchen facilities in New York to open. And of course, everyone knows now has since been acquired by Kitchen United, which started out here on the West Coast. I'm in LA. And so that's a certain style of ghost kitchen that's been growing. And you wanted to do something different. So tell me about when you were there watching what was going on. What did you feel needed to be done differently? And how have you translated that into Hungry House?
Yeah, so obviously just an incredible place to be as the ghost kitchen industry really took off. And so some of the things that I noticed while working with all of our different operators within the ghost kitchen and then licensing our technology to others is that, there was a real underestimation of the importance of having storefronts, like as a storefront, as a way to create local awareness of your brand, even through the delivery context, right? Because we saw that people in the local neighborhood, they just didn't know that they could even search these amazing new concepts in their neighborhood on the delivery apps, right? They just didn't know they were there. So the importance of a storefront was really something that I saw as being a way to make the ghost kitchen model more successful. And then I also saw just the impact of the third-party delivery apps on the margins of these businesses. It's really hard to make the financials work when maybe 100% or 90% of your revenue are coming through apps that take 30% commission, right? That pretty much wipes out your bottom line, no matter how much you're optimizing labor or supply chain with streamlining your menu, et cetera. So what we saw was the more successful strategies was when you had a really strong native business and actually were able to control your margins when it came to the cost of logistics and delivery. And so, these two ideas really helped drive some of the core strategies in Hungry House, which is that we must always have a storefront. I want people to know Hungry House exists. We are building a brand that stands for quality and transparency. And so having a storefront really helps us bring that home to customers and explain what we're doing and why. And the other part of it too is that, when thinking about having a strong native business and reducing reliance on the third-party delivery apps, really requires a very intentional construction of how you plan to do customer acquisition. And so that's why we partner with amazing chefs that have existing followings, because they've proven out they have something that's of interest. And customers now can finally go and purchase food from this person. And they're not necessarily going to need to go find that food on a third-party delivery app. Rather, we have a much more efficient and seamless experience when our partners are able to just put a link in their Instagram story for people to click on to go buy their food. And so what that means for us is, unlike your regular ghost kitchen, you know, we have really strong revenue channels of walk-in kiosk ordering and pickup, as well as an entirely native-driven business, all of which corresponds to much higher margins than your traditional ghost kitchen third-party delivery business.
Now, do you have your own delivery drivers, or are you using the third-party guys for the last mile?
So we are using the logistics products that are made available through DoorDash Drive and Uber Eats, which allows us still, though, to pay just a flat fee for the cost of delivery and then allocate whatever portion of that we want to the customers. And so part of us actually really building a halo around our brand and being very intentional about our partnerships, about our supply chain, is because we believe that we are creating experience that, you know, really shouldn't be competing on price. I don't want to be discounting our food, discounting our partners' food, and kind of having that whole race to the bottom dynamic you see with promotions on the third-party apps. Rather, you know, again, we're building that business that is highly craveable items from people that are loved and trusted by their following.
And so I know some of your partners, like Woldy, for example, has an e-commerce, you know, link, I guess, of his own. Is that right? So can you explain why you're doing that and how that's different?
Yeah. So when we actually built out our native web platform, which offers pickup and delivery to all of Brooklyn, the idea was that we didn't want to just feature all of these brands mishmashed together in simple kind of menu category format, right? We really wanted to be able to infuse both the content and the commerce behind this whole business model, because so much of this is wrapped up in being able to tell the story of our partners really effectively, and then converting customers in a digital-only context, but having them really trust who we are and what we're doing. So what that meant was we created a page for each one of our various partners so that we have a statement about the ethos of their brand, photography, links to their social media, all the things that customers, I find, go looking for when they are on their delivery app, right? You're going to see a name of a restaurant, and if you don't recognize it, you're going to be like, oh, do they have an Instagram? I want to see photos of the food. And do they have a real address, or is this fake? You know, talking to, I lecture at Cornell University sometimes, and I was talking to them in a class I did this fall. And I said, you know, I was explaining virtual brands, and some of them had ordered from Mr. Beast Burger. And they were telling me, you know, we know what's going on in technology. Like, we can do our research. When I see a restaurant, I am going to see those reviews on Google. I'm going to go see if it has an Instagram. Like, is it real and does it look good? So a lot of the intention behind our own web platform is to really be able to answer those questions and provide an experience that's differentiated, brand forward, and ultimately tells the story of the people we work with.
Well, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, because, you know, you're up against a growing, you know, crowd of virtual brands that are out there on the third party marketplaces and everywhere. And you know, we've seen Reef in the news a lot, one of your competitors in the ghost kitchen world, and which has a, you know, very different model. But there are some questions being raised about where the food is coming from. And, you know, that is something that I know in talking to virtual brand operators over the years, they've said that, you know, the younger generation doesn't really care, you know, where food is coming from.
Yeah.
I think arguably they do, and they will more and more. But what are your thoughts on that?
I would agree with you in that. I think the younger generation is taken for granted as just these like tech robots that will just buy anything that has like a really kitschy name. I actually don't think that's true at all. This is the most advanced generation when it comes to seeing through whether a brand on their Instagram is being genuine or being fake, right? And they're going to actually call you out on it too. These are experts, right? And so I don't think they should be treated as, a new generation that will just buy anything online. Rather, I think through the lens of them being incredibly advanced at understanding online cues and whether a brand is real, good, or doing what it says it does, you know, we're trying to answer those questions. You know, what you said, right, is that is something that really troubled me as I saw the virtual brand industry explode in the last 18 months. There is no transparency. Who is going to hold anyone accountable when it comes to supply chain or safety or the workforce practices? Is it the brand? Is it the operator? It was becoming more and more obscure, right? And so, you know, prior to Zuul, I worked at Dig In, now known as Dig, and, you know, was a big part of our supply chain and menu development efforts to create a really unique culinary experience where all of the food was very thoughtfully sourced. And so I'm bringing that ethos into Hungry House, and it's something that attracts greater culinary talent because chefs care about this. And all of them ask me where I was sourcing the beef or the mushrooms or whatever, you know, various important parts of our supply chain they cared about. I had to have a strong answer for where that food was coming from. And I think that consumers demand that more as well, especially when you look at the amount of brands that are now sustainability oriented and thinking through really what it means to communicate with your customers and create a really trusting relationship.
Well, I wonder what's going to happen, and maybe give us your perspective on the landscape of regulation that ghost kitchens might be facing. I mean, what do you see ahead of us? You know, ghost kitchens, it depends on where you are. There are different rules, different permitting. You know, there's the way that some are kind of trying to find a way in through being labeled as more of a food truck or a trailer. And so what do you see ahead for this? I mean, this was a conversation that's really started before the pandemic. I remember there being testimony in New York City about, needing more regulations for some of the kitchens and that were growing out there. What do you see ahead? What do you think is coming?
Yeah. So one thing that I feel is really exciting to see is that just generally the awareness of our government officials and the extent to which they understand the industry is like improving, right? Because at that original testimony in New York, where there was Zuul, Kitchen United, some others, you know, there was still a lot of education happening in terms of the various different operating models within the larger ghost kitchen space. And so I am definitely excited to see it evolve. There are a couple of key things that I think are that are going to be solved for over the next like kind of medium term horizon, which is one, obviously how the delivery apps exist as a core part of so many restaurants' businesses, and whether their practices when it comes to commission or sharing of data are fair and sustainable for the restaurants that have become reliant on them. That's a question that I think is going to continue to play out and be answered in different ways, as we've seen various cities respond to the fees with caps and whatnot. The other component that I think you were referencing is just really the structure of the virtual brand industry and creating transparency with customers about where their food is coming from. You know, one thing that has always stuck out to me is that when you're buying food from an establishment that is a virtual brand on one of the third-party delivery apps, it's going to be really hard for you to actually find any DOH information on their latest health score, right? And so, you know, for Hungry House, the way I think about this is it's Hungry House through and through. We are trying to be very transparent with it, but I'll definitely acknowledge that the other models that exist out there right now, there are really not regulatory scenarios that accounted for the changes in the industry. So obviously, as we go along, I do think that we are all learning more how this actually operates, and then probably are going to end up in regulatory scenarios that better match, you know, ultimately what the goal is here, which is making sure that small businesses survive and thrive, and then consumers are also safe.
Well, okay. And so you are now looking at multiplying this model, right? So you're already looking for a second location?
Yes, that's correct.
Where are you looking?
So we're looking into Manhattan. Ideally, actually, throughout 2022, our plan is to expand there with at least a few locations that we can have full coverage of most of Manhattan by the end of the year. And the goal that's really driving all of this is to be able to work with increasingly larger in scope kind of culinary voices that maybe have broader platforms and followings that, you know, me just being open in Brooklyn probably isn't going to meet the full potential of what a launch with Hungry House would look like if I were able to actually cover all of Manhattan. And so our near-term goal is being able to really have the type of reach that is going to be super attractive to some of these more these top tier brands, and ideally be able to also expand our work with our existing partners. They're going to be able to gain access to a larger customer base, which is going to be very exciting for all of their brands.
So for example, Apocalypse Burger, Martha's concept, which I think this is her first foray into New York, right? This is her first outlet that she'll have in New York City. She's, you know, a bit mostly in Indianapolis. You're saying that it would be more attractive for her to be at the Hungry House in Brooklyn and the one in Manhattan and the one in Long Island next or wherever you're going, et cetera, et cetera. So you're thinking that you will multiply the outlets for the partners that you're working with.
Yes, absolutely. So for us in the earlier stages, you know, obviously we want to make sure our marketing messages are really clear about what you can get where. Obviously, as I think we consider expansion into other cities, there will be regional differences in our offering. There will be the ability, which I actually think is a really exciting proposition, to partner with just a chef in, let's say, Miami, who has a really great following in Miami, that we're not necessarily working with them in New York, but it helps us actually explain the model to the local community, whichever city we're going into. So in the future, I could see us having both national scale partners with brands that are really going to play well at that type of scale and be able to actually cover many different markets. But we can also do really targeted partnerships with local voices that are going to be really impactful for those local communities and for customers that have been waiting to access that food.
And you have four now at this first location. Do you plan to add more brands? Or do you have the capacity for that?
Yeah. So the interesting thing about our model is that we don't actually need to create an entire new restaurant concept for each of our partners. Unlike the traditional model where, let's say, you're another ghost kitchen operator and you're licensing brands, you really have to deal with each restaurant in its entirety, you know, that you're working with to license the menu. For us, because we have a more malleable format where we partner with both restaurateurs, but also chefs that maybe have just like a few signature items that they want to launch, we could launch a 2-item menu with someone and have it be a fantastic collaboration with them selling their signature items online. So, you know, for us, it could be that we add one new brand and maybe it's 5 menu items. We could also launch 4 more and each one is 1 item. So I see it being a really exciting capability of our model where we can be much more flexible when it comes to the menu construction itself with each of our partnerships.
And you have some powerful investors. You have Wilshire Lane, private equity firm that's already involved, and you're raising money for the next move. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
So I noticed actually you're also open Monday through Friday and closed on the weekends. Why is that?
So that was really just us getting our sea legs underneath us as we open this first location. The primary kind of customer flow in the Navy Yard, looking at our hyper local community, is that it's really lunch driven as a business during the week. And so our immediate goal when opening the business was, how can we make sure we serve the Navy Yard community really, really effectively? Have all of our focus be on making sure that the people who are going to see us every single day and be our brand evangelists are having the best possible experience. We're actually opening weekends, though, starting in 2 weekends officially. We're doing a bit of a soft launch this weekend, but we see weekends being a huge opportunity for us. That's where a lot of delivery happens, especially on like Sunday afternoons when people don't want to cook. Right. So we're really excited to expand our hours and are growing the team to accommodate that.
Okay. Well, it sounds really exciting and it sounds so interesting. I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me that we're seeing so many different variations on this theme. And I mean, do you see that we will see more consolidation with, you know, with Kitchen United coming in for Zuul? Do you feel like that's also ahead, or do you feel like we need to have this more entrepreneurial look at this whole model until we figure out what works best?
So I think consolidation is really going to happen depending on like what part of the value chain you're in. So for Zuul and Kitchen United, obviously real estate and being able to have a presence in different markets is really important to that business. We're seeing consolidation on the tech front too, because every single tech platform involved in a restaurant's business at this point is looking to increase their key features to make sure that they have as broad of a set of features to keep restaurants within their ecosystem. Now, when it comes to other parts of the ghost kitchen model, really what I think is happening in the space that I'm playing in, when it comes to working with great brands and the operation side, I think fundamentally we're in a battle for the best content on the internet. That's where I see everything going when it comes to food delivery. So the people who can work with the best brands, you're going to be competing for, you know, whether it's like having a certain operator within your ghost kitchen that you know will make your facility more successful, or whether you're an operator looking to partner with the best new influencer who's going to drive you the most customers and views and create all these YouTube videos. At the end of the day, it's the competition for that, as it has always been in the food business, like who has the best concept. And so people are going after it in a lot of different ways. And I see that ecosystem continuing to evolve probably as, you know, we've really only started getting into this virtual brand world in the last 18 to 24 months in a serious way. And so I think many more things and concepts and ideas are going to come to light. And I'm just as excited as everyone else, and obviously throwing my hat in the ring for what I think is the way forward here. So we'll see, but I think it's going to continue to evolve.
Okay. All right. Well, looking forward to hearing more about Hungry House as it grows, and stay in touch. Thanks for spending the time with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Lisa. Appreciate it.